You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, John 11. So as we have been talking about every week, we are talking about signs. The book of John is structured around these signs. And tonight we have the penultimate, the second to last sign in the book of John, the Samaya. As we've discussed, these are, again, physical miracles with deeper spiritual implications, like Jesus feeding the 5,000, for instance, or healing the man born blind we saw a couple weeks ago. We're going to get the second to last one, and the last one for a while, that we'll see in this book tonight in John 11. Let's get into it. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Although we are being introduced to this family for the first time in the book of John, Jesus was not unfamiliar with this family. He had an extensive relationship with them, as he loves them, as is noted about Lazarus in verse 3. He also loved Mary and Martha. And that will be explored further in next week's section we talk about in chapter 12. He has a very close relationship with this family. Lazarus is sick. When Jesus heard this, he said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." As we'll see, Jesus is not saying that this sickness is not fatal. It is fatal. Lazarus is about to die if he has not already. Yet he's saying that this will not ultimately end in death, but rather that there's something more coming, something that's going to reveal, that's going to glorify God and Jesus both. So now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Some translations of your Bibles will put these verses in tension with one another. For instance, if you read the New Living Translation, it reads, "So although Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days." You see, that's putting them in tension. He loves them, but he decided to stay. That's not how it reads. It reads that it is because he loved them that he stayed 2 more days, that his delay was motivated by his love. Confusing, right? But we need to read on to understand why would Jesus delay? Why wouldn't he go immediately? Why wouldn't he try to save Lazarus as he's on his deathbed from dying? So we don't accept that interpretation. It says, "And then he said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.' But Rabbi, they said, 'A short while ago, the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back?'" Right, we just covered this last week, John 10, verses 31 and 39. Jesus said, "I am one with the Father," and they pick up stones to stone him. Like that like just happened, you know, the other day. And they're like, "Hey, I don't know if you remember, but we almost just died." And so they're putting the pieces together, like, if you go back to Judea, this might be the end. Of course, not realizing that his death is exactly what he's marching toward. It's exactly what he's working toward. But they don't get that yet. And so he says, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." This cryptic kind of riddle statement, I believe what Jesus is getting at here is that as long as he walks in his Father's light, as in as long as he does what his Father has called him to do, he will be safe. He knows where this is ending. He knows where this is headed. It's headed to the cross. And Jesus knows that his Father's will be accomplished through him. And so he's saying, as long as I'm doing that, we're good. And I know that I need to go. I know that I need to go and see Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And I think by implication, as he said in chapter 9, if you remember a couple weeks ago back at the beginning, he said, "I'm the light of the world. And as long as you're with me, we have the light. We need to accomplish the works of the day before I depart." I think that's also in view here, that the disciples too are protected, that we're okay, even in the face of death. So after Jesus said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. Yes, the disciples, obtuse again, not very uncommon, perhaps because of their grief or maybe their fear, maybe they think they're gonna die if they return to Judea. They say this, and so Jesus says plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him." An odd statement. He's glad that he wasn't there. He's glad that he couldn't have been there to prevent it. Right? What is about to ensue is going to have such radical implications on their faith. He's like, it's better that we're going now as opposed to when we first heard about this. Not only for them, but also for Lazarus and his family, whom he loves. And so Thomas, also known as Didymus, or the twin, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Unclear whether this is a statement of courage or of sarcasm. I've always taken it to be the latter. But either way, Thomas is not really understanding what Jesus said there a couple verses ago about, you know, what I believe to be a statement of protection. Let's just go, and if we die, we die. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Why would John point that out? He'd been in the tomb 4 days. Why four? Well, as we learn, rabbinic tradition held that a soul would hover over its body for 3 days, wanting to re-enter it. But as soon as decomposition set in, after that third day, the soul would leave, and the belief was that death was at that point irreversible. Now, the fact that they would have a belief like this, that someone may not truly be dead, even though they appear to be dead, is not really without warrant, okay? Without the benefit of modern medicine, it would be very difficult to tell unconsciousness from death. And even with the benefit of modern medicine, sometimes we believe people are dead when they're not actually dead. I just found an article from last year where an Ecuadorian woman revived and knocked on her coffin at her own funeral. Of course, she died about a week later, unfortunately. But she came back, they pronounced her dead. And she knocked on her own coffin. So for them to believe this, to think, you know, there might be a couple days, we need to wait this out and see if they come back, it's really not without warrant. Now, it doesn't have biblical backing. This is not a biblical teaching. But Jesus does appear to be aware of it, and it does appear to be presupposed here in this very passage. And by delaying 2 days, not one, not a couple hours, but 2 days, this ensured that nobody would interpret what's about to happen as a coincidence. He is really dead, and everyone there believes as much. That's the significance of 4 days. That's why Jesus waited 2 extra days. So verse 18 says, now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. Yes, so the fact that many families come is probably denotes that Mary and Martha and Lazarus were from a significant family. They were also probably pretty wealthy as well. But many Jews coming from Jerusalem, I don't think Jews from Jerusalem came out for every villager who had lost a family member. And so this was probably a relatively prominent family, and many people come to comfort and to experience the funeral. Now, Jewish funerals in this culture were structurally different from ours. For example, you were expected, even if you were a poor family, you were expected to hire at least 2 flute players and 1 wailing woman. Okay, so back in this day, they still had side hustles, but it was not Uber Eats, it was crying loudly, right? That was their thing. That was what you were supposed to do, because when the emotions came down in a funeral, the wailing woman would bring them back, right, with a loud cry to keep the emotions flowing and going at the funeral. Their funerals were also a lot longer than ours, probably typically about a week. And we even see Old Testament examples of mourning of 30 days, much longer, much more emotional on their sleeves. Now, that being said, while funerals there were structurally different, emotionally, they were the same. Right, there is no pain like the pain of losing a loved one. Grief. It's very difficult to describe, but it's much, much harder to go through. If you've ever lost somebody, you know exactly what I mean, right? Grief can bring us into an array of emotions. To lose somebody, to grieve, it can make you hot with anger. It can blind you with your tears. It can numb you with its pain, right? Grief is like a tidal wave that comes crashing down upon you. You feel enveloped by it. You feel like you can't breathe. You can't escape it. And you're not sure when you're going to be able to get your next breath of air. Grief is unexpected. That tidal wave hits you at random times, right? It just takes one memory. It just takes one overheard comment, one scent, one location to suddenly send you spiraling so that you're drowning again. Grief is a very, very difficult, difficult battle. C.S. Lewis has a book called A Grief Observed. He's a Christian author. And it's about the death of his wife, Helen. I think some of the ways he pens this is really encapsulates in many ways what grief is like. He says, "It's not true that I'm always thinking of Helen. Work and conversation make that impossible. But the times when I'm not are perhaps my worst. For then, though I've forgotten the reason, there is spread over everything a vague sense of wrongness, of something amiss. Like in those dreams where nothing terrible occurs, but the atmosphere, the taste of the whole thing, it's deadly. So with this, I see the rowan berries reddening and don't know for a moment why they, of all things, should be depressing. I hear a clock strike and some quality it always had before has gone out of its sound. What's wrong with the world to make it so flat, shabby, worn out looking? And then I remember. I think I'm beginning to understand why grief feels like suspense. It comes from the frustration of so many impulses that have become habitual. Thought after thought, feeling after feeling, action after action at Helen for their object. And now their target is gone. I keep on through habit fitting an arrow to this string, and then I have to remember, and I lay the bow down. So many roads led thought to Helen. I set out on one of them, but now there's an impassable frontier post across it. So many roads once, now so many cul-de-sacs. I like that imagery. I think it's fitting. When you really love people and then you lose them, the ways, like there are things that remind you of them, right? Experiences, places, sense even, like so many different things. And it's a road leading you to them. Only now, instead of them being there, it's a dead end. There was a house, it's been demolished. There was a park, it's been leveled. It's gone now, and you can't get it back. That's sad. It's very difficult to go through, to live through. That's exactly what he's describing. That's what grief is like. And that's what we enter into here. When we talk about the scene, the setting, the feeling that is predominant in this location where Jesus enters. And so when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died." If you had been here, God, how different things would be. Yeah, if is a common refrain in grief, right? If you've grieved, you felt this. We think, if I had done this, you know, if I had just done something differently. My wife and I just watched the kids' movie Bridge to Terabithia the other day. If you ever heard of it, it's old, whatever. But in it, the main character is this kid named Jesse. And he, at the end, he intentionally doesn't invite his best friend Leslie on a field trip. And he comes home to the news that Leslie has died on a rope swing that they made and went over together all the time. And the grieving process just starts to go through him. He gets angry, he runs, he screams, he tells the people, told them that they're lying. He cries, he tries to sleep and numb it away. And then towards the end of the movie, he's running through the woods just in so much pain, and his father finds him and he collapses into his arms, weeping. He says, "This is all my fault. This is my fault. Because I didn't invite her and I didn't want to. And if I had just invited her, she would not have died." This is what it can feel like when you're grieving. I felt like this with my friends who've died. If only I had just given them that piece of advice, asked that perfect question, right? If only I had that magic bullet, maybe they would still be here today. Or we might say, if I had just said blank. Sometimes we don't feel regret so much as we just wish for another chance. right? Just this past year, my father-in-law passed away suddenly, randomly. He was sick, he had cancer, but there was no expectation that he was gonna die when he did. We didn't have the chance to say goodbye. It didn't happen. We didn't get the, you know, sitting around the hospital bed, sending him off to be with Jesus. He was just gone. And we're left, his children are left with just the seemingly innocuous last conversations that they had. How much you wish just for one more opportunity to talk, just one more chance to have coffee, to sit, to tell them how much you love them, but that opportunity is gone. That's what we feel in grief. If I had just told them that, I wish I had that chance, that opportunity. Or we might feel anger. We often will. We say, man, if they had just, man, I feel angry with them because we were at odds. They hurt me and we never reconciled. They never apologized. Now I have to live with that while they're dead. That may even get you down a whole spiral of guilt over being angry at somebody who's not here anymore. And of course, for anyone who's spiritual, we're gonna ask, if you, Lord, had blank, anyone with a spiritual belief in a God, when they're going through grief, they are going to ask, where were you, God? When we go through pain like this, we pray harder than we've ever prayed. And to feel the pain of not getting the answer that we wanted can be the scariest thing. That's exactly what Mary and Martha are going through. Their brother that they love was sick. They prayed, they prayed, they prayed, and he died. They knew God personally as their friend. Again, Lewis, just walking us through his grief in a very vulnerable way, says, meanwhile, where is God? When you're happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing God, so happy that you're tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. And after that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic that silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might even be an empty house. Was it ever even inhabited? Was God ever really there? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God, he says. The real dangers of coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not so there's no God after all, but so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. He had to just walk us through his raw emotions like that. Powerful. Those are the kinds of questions we often ask ourselves. This is some of the most deep emotions you will ever feel when you lose someone you love. And death and grief can take down our faith completely. They threaten our faith. We can lose it over this. Many people have. And that threat is exactly what faces Mary and Martha, though Martha expresses hope when she states, but I know, Jesus, that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Even though she believes that Jesus did not show up in time, she says, I still trust you. I still trust that you can do whatever it is that needs to be done. And Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. Intentionally ambiguous. Does he mean he's gonna raise again right now? Or that he'll raise at the end, right? Because Jews believe that all, you know, Jews would rise at the end times. That's how Martha takes it. She says, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. But that's not what Jesus meant. And so he says plainly, and perhaps the most remarkable I am statement in this book, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Several incredible things going on here. For one, to say, I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus here is taking Martha's attention away from an abstract belief in resurrection at the end of time to a personal belief in the God who is able to make it happen. It's not just that this will happen someday. You're looking at the man who's going to do it, right? Resurrection is not just something that God does. He's saying, that's what I am. Just like Jesus said in chapter 6, it's not just that I give the bread of life, I am the bread of life. So too, he does not just provide resurrection, as we saw in chapter 5, but he is the resurrection. There is no eternal life outside of him. He is the source, the sole arbiter of resurrection, of spiritual life. So he's personalizing it. You look at me. I'm the one who's gonna make this happen, Jesus says. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Yeah, pointing out again, Lazarus, right? He just died. But there's something about belief in Jesus that changes that, right? And that's gonna be true for us too. You think about my life, you think about yours. We are finite beings. We are finite creatures. We are not, we have an expiration date. Every single person goes through it. And yet, what we believe about Jesus has some kind of impact on what happens to us when we die. The question of what happens next after death, it bears extreme significance on how we live right now. And what Jesus says here is that the core of this, the key of this, is that it all comes down to what you believe. He says, I am the resurrection of the life. Do you believe this? You see, the Bible teaches that your eternal destiny and mine completely rests on what you and I believe about Jesus. It says, if we believe in him, we will live even though we die, right? Even though we have an expiration here that we will live on in eternity forever. The sole person who can give you spiritual life, who can give you future resurrection, is Jesus Christ. This is why he went to the cross. This is why he died for you. This is why he rose from the dead, to prove his jurisdiction over death, to pay the judgment, the penalty of our sin in the boldest expression of love, so that the dead can live forever with God. You have the opportunity to secure your own place in heaven, that you can live even though you die, and it all rests on what you believe about Jesus. Martha says in response, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. A remarkable statement of faith from Martha. I believe that you're God. I believe that you're God's Messiah. I believe you came into this world to pay for my sin, is what she will soon come to believe as soon as she sees him on the cross. This is what it takes. If you want to go to heaven, if you want the loved ones in your life to go to heaven, to be with God, expressing belief in Jesus like this, this is all you must do. It's not good works. It's belief. It's trust. I believe, Jesus, that you are God. I believe that you died for me. I believe you rose from the dead. That secures you a place of eternal life with God so that you will continue to live even though you die. Well, after she said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and he's asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. She does the exact same thing Martha does. She's feeling the same way, although her grief expresses itself differently. She does not follow this up with a theological statement, but rather she just crumples into tears. And Jesus, observing this, seeing her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. A lot of debate over what this term deeply moved in spirit means. The Greek word embrimaomai in extra biblical literature means anger, outrage, or emotional indignation, unequivocally. means something to that effect. I think when we get this term in English, deeply moved in spirit does not make me think angry, outraged. But that's what the term is really communicating, that there is a deep anger within Jesus. It's inside him. It's in his spirit. It's internal. But he feels anger over what he is observing. And we have to ask, anger at what? Who or what is Jesus angry with? Angry at? Well, I'll tell you, he's not angry with the people. Right? It's not them. He's observing them. He's seeing their weeping. And he feels this deep emotional state within himself. No, he's not angry with them. He's angry with death. He's angry at what he's seeing, but it's not anger in the sense of losing Lazarus. Because in about 2 minutes, he's gonna raise him from the dead. He's not angry that Lazarus died or that he's separated, but rather as he looks at the state of affairs of the human race, he feels anger that death is a part of the human experience. You see, when we open our Bibles to the very beginning, Genesis 1 and 2, we see that death was never intended to be a part of the human experience. Death was introduced by human sin, we read in Genesis 3. And so for millennia, right, people are going through losing loved ones, but it was never meant to be this way. And that outrages Jesus that people are going through this. He considers death an adversary, an enemy. We read in 1 Corinthians 15, he says the last enemy to be destroyed is death. Death is Jesus' adversary. He came to defeat it. And he feels anger that human beings are going through this because it was never meant to be this way. He says, "Where have you laid him? Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. I think it's interesting, you know, come and see is a refrain that Jesus has used throughout this letter. I don't know if you've noticed that. He frequently has told people to come and see his goodness, right? He's revealed himself. He said, come and see. I'll show you. I'll show you what I'm like, especially at the beginning of his ministry when he called his disciples. The God who has invited people to come and see his glory is now being invited to come and see the result of human sin. And it's devastating to him. He weeps, but he does not weep like we weep. Even the Greek words are different for Jesus wept versus the other people. He's not weeping because he thinks Lazarus is gone. He knows what's coming. His weeping is different. The Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Some cynicism, right? Some people wondering, well, why didn't Jesus prevent this? If you remember chapter 9, Jesus healed the eyes of a man born blind. That had never been done before. Couldn't he have prevented this sickness? Isn't this child's play in comparison? Jesus is like, prevent it? Let me do you one better. How about reversing it? So 38, it says, Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a stone, it was a cave with a stone laid across its entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there's a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So Martha, not understanding the full implications of their earlier conversation, that he's about to raise Lazarus from the dead, objects, but Jesus reminds her, again, everything he does is for the glory of God. All we need to do is say yes. We just need to be willing to listen. And so she does, and they roll away the stone, and Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. And when he had said this, he called out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen, cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. A remarkable miracle to bring him back. Now, this is a resuscitation, not a resurrection, meaning that he is gonna eventually die again in the future. Resurrection, being raised for eternity, forever. Nonetheless, this is amazing. what just happened here, to raise Lazarus from the dead. Imagine the elation of the sisters who have been grieving that we lost our brother. He's back. Imagine the crowd, the shock, the awe. Many of these people don't believe in Jesus yet. Oh my, he just brought someone back from the dead. Isn't that absurd? I mean, he was definitely 100% dead and now he's here. I'm looking at him. And you can also imagine the probable disappointment of Lazarus, who just got to spend 4 days with his God in perfection, apart from human sin. And God turns him and says, hey buddy, bad news. It's time to go back. I'm sure he was very happy to see his sisters and Jesus. We read, therefore many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. As you should. That's amazing. Right? It's truly incredible, but not everyone believes. So some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, this was the highest ruling, the judicial ruling authority in Jewish culture. It was made up of something like 70 or 71 Jewish men. And it was presided over by the high priest, at this point, a man named Caiaphas in history. And so they say, what are we accomplishing? The answer is nothing, but you know, they keep going. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. How could they? And then the Romans will come and they will take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You don't realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. John adds, Caiaphas did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take Jesus's life. Yeah, no more of this. Let's try to trap him so that we can like try him, put him on trial. He's guilty. We've made the decision. It's over. We just need to capture him so that we can kill him. That is what they have decided at this point. And so Jesus, by bringing Lazarus out of his grave, has quickened his own path into one himself. He's heading for the cross. As we enter here into John 12 next week, we're going to enter the final week of Jesus' life. As we read, in verse 54, therefore Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to the region near the wilderness to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. And that's John 11. You know, you think about this sign. What's the point of this Samaya, right? Again, physical miracle, deeper implication, spiritual. What is it? I'll tell you at least one. Is that this Samaya was a picture of Jesus' impending death and resurrection, a pale one in comparison. But Jesus, in 6 days from now, is going to go to the cross and die for human sin, only to raise 3 days later, not just for a period of time, but forever. He's gonna die to pay for human sin, to pay for our judgment, so that we don't have to go to hell, that we can go to heaven. And he's going to prove his victory over death by raising from the dead so that we can also be assured that the same is going to happen to us who believe. That's what's coming. This picture, this Samaya was incredible, but it was a pale sign of what was coming in just a week. So we think about this passage and how we may apply it. A couple thoughts. Number one, some thoughts about what I think this has to do with our view of God. You think about, what is God's position toward our grief? Think about that Lewis quote from earlier, how we feel that if you've grieved, you know. There's that temptation, that feeling, God, where were you? What were you doing? Are you indifferent? Do you really care? Are you powerful enough? But when we look at a passage like this one, we see that God is powerful, that he is acting, even though we might not see it or realize it or understand it. These guys got something so much greater than they could have imagined, so faith-bolstering. And on top of it, we see so much about who God is and what he's like. He is not indifferent toward your pain. He is angry with you. He cries with you. He is outraged with you. And most importantly, he did something about it. He stepped in. He intervened. He died. He laid down his own life so that you and the people you love can convene and commune in heaven forever. And it's only about believing a standard that every single person can meet. What an incredible intervention of the God of the universe. And so while we're tempted to believe that God is malicious, indifferent, we must fight in our grief to remember his true nature. Secondly, when it comes to grief, I think an important point to make is that there's no one right way to do this. Okay, when you grieve, it's easy to feel like, am I supposed to be feeling this way? Or what about this person over here? Mary and Martha grieved very differently. That didn't matter. That was okay. What we're told biblically is this. It's not that we don't grieve, but that we don't grieve as those who have no hope. 1 Thessalonians 4:13, it says, brothers and sisters, we don't want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. You see, we are eternal beings. When people die, when you die, when I die, we do not live on in memories and on mantles. We truly live on eternally. And when we know anyone who has a relationship with the God of the universe, we can be confident that they are with him in paradise. That we one day will meet them, that we'll see them, that we'll be able to interact with them perfectly forever. That doesn't mean that we don't grieve. It's not that we don't feel pain. We do feel pain. Grief is not easy. To lose somebody, to not be able to interact with them until an unknown future date, that is scary, that is hard, that is frustrating. But we do have hope. We are confident. We believe the fact that we are going to see them again. We know that because of what Jesus did. And so when we feel that pain of grief, we look to him as the resurrection and the life. We don't put forward just the platitudes. I know they're in a better place. I know that everything will be okay. No, this is so much more than that. We know because we look to him who died and rose, and we are confident that we too will die and rise with him so long as we put our faith in him. Finally, just want to give you a couple thoughts about us ourselves. I'll tell you one thing, we're fragile. Lazarus was not an old man. He got sick and he died. We don't know how old he was, but he was not very old, as far as we can tell. And we don't know when we're gonna die. You don't know when you're gonna die. And so it becomes so important for you to consider what comes next, because you might not be able to wait until you're 70 or 80 when most people want to think about that kind of thing. It's time to think about it now, because you don't know when the end is going to be here. What you believe right now determines your eternal destiny. And the fact of this passage is that your death does not have to end in death. That you can put your trust in Jesus Christ, that you can call out to him and tell him, I believe you. And when you die, that is merely the next step into a greater and longer and perfect adventure with God and all who put their trust in him. So that's what we have. John 11. Lord, I am very thankful for the fact that, you know, that we get this picture here, that we can know, you know, confidence that we're going to see people we love again. And I'm really eager to see some friends, some family that have gone. And I'm really eager to see more of those friends and family come to Christ now so that they can be there too. And I pray for anyone here and anyone involved in the lives of any of the people here, the people that we love, God, I pray for anyone in that situation who has never come into a relationship with you, I pray that they'll do that. I just pray, God, that they'll throw off this idea that they can earn their salvation from you by doing good things, and that instead that they will turn to you in dependence and in trust, and that they'll believe and express that belief that you and you alone can save them. We thank you so much for anyone who does that, and we pray that you'll help us in our grief to turn to passages like this to remember you for what you really are like and not what our grief is trying to tell us you're like. Pray that in your name. Amen.